So tonight we move into Genesis chapter 19, and if you remember, chapter 18 finished with Abraham having a conversation with one of these angels about the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Most likely on Abraham's mind, as he was asking whether or not there would be, how many righteous people would it take for God to save the city, most likely on his mind was his nephew Lot. And so eventually they get down to where if there are 10 righteous people, he says, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. But then, of course, that also implies that if there's less than 10, that he would. And what we'll end up finding is that that is, in fact, the case. There are less than 10. So as you move into chapter 19, there had been three angels that had gone to Abraham. One of them stayed behind to talk with Abraham, and the other two left heading for Sodom and Gomorrah. These two neighboring cities. And chapter 19 catches us back to those angels. It says, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. Now, there's several different little details in this that probably seem insignificant but are worth noting. As they came into the city of Sodom, it was a very typical thing when people came into a city. You didn't have hotels like you have today. What you were counting on was the hospitality of others. And that Eastern hospitality is a very big deal. That if you came into a town, you expected that somebody would have you into their home. Lot, of course, is going to do that. But if it were not for Lot, it seems pretty clear that that was not going to happen, which is in and of itself a statement about the condition of the hearts of the people of the town. The other thing is it mentions that Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Now, when we think of a gate, you typically think of, just like a gate in a picket fence or something like that. That's not what is meant here by Lot sitting in the gate. The walls of cities were very large, thick things, and oftentimes there was a space in between these kind of inner and outer walls. And most of the time, it would go unused. It was the thickness of those walls and that gap there was due to war, if the city was ever taken under siege. But the rest of the time, it would have essentially been left unused. So what often happened was that was the area of judgment. And they have done some excavations, probably the most notable of those being the city of Dan, where they've actually found the seats of the judges that would have sat in the gate. So to sit in the gate is not just a statement of position of Lot. In other words, you say, well, why was Lot there at the gate? Well, realistically, he was there because he was a man of renown and importance in the city as a judge. And in fact, it will kind of allude to that later on as the people deal with Lot in the middle of the night. But Lot was a man of prominence, is what I want you to see. And yet he was very much counter the culture that he was living in. And so in Genesis 19, Lot comes up to them and he says, now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, and then you may rise early and go on your way. And they said, however, no, but we shall spend the night in the square, that is, in the common open square. Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. From the events that are going to unfold here, you can kind of guess as to why it is that Lot would so strongly urge them not to stay in the common town square, right? It wasn't safe. That's just what it came down to. Sodom and Gomorrah were not a safe place for strangers. And so in verse 4, it says, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And that's a very important detail. This wasn't a small detachment of men that will surround the house, but these are people of every demographic in the city. In other words, this behavior, which would eventually make the name Sodom associated with homosexuality the same, to the point where we use the term to sodomize to refer to homosexuality, was part of the whole culture of the city from young to old. And they called the lot and they said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them at the door when he shut the door behind him, and he said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." So, one, you see the request, and then you see Lot saying, "No, don't do it." But what's Lot's counter argument? It's pretty awful, right? I mean, he's offering his daughters in exchange for these men. In no way can we in any way condone that behavior on Lot's part. When we talk about Lot being a righteous man, this does not mean Lot was a guy who did everything perfect by any means, shape, or form. But in comparison to the rest of the city, in the cesspool that had become Sodom and Gomorrah, he was the best man. Now, that's an awfully sad state of affairs, isn't it? If the best guy there, he says, no, don't do this wicked thing in taking these men and having relations with them. I have two daughters, I'll give them to you. In what sort of a dark place does the world have to be for that to be the best guy around? Right. That's what I want you to think about. When we have God destroying Sodom and Gomorrah and everybody in it, how wicked of a nation of city-states had they become? And we already have the answer to it. How wicked were they? God told Abraham. How many have to be left that are righteous? Just 10 guys and I'll save them. Just 10 people. And there were not even 10. And so he offers his daughters. And then in verse 7 it says he makes that offer. And then you go down to verse 9. He says, "But they said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, this one came in as an alien and already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. Now you look at it, they have these plans to put it bluntly, to rape these two men. Lot offers his daughters, which was abominable. And yet, what was their answer to that offer? No, we're not interested. We want them. What we're looking at is a level of sexual deviancy that had reached such a degree that you can understand why God is going to see their sins as being full. Of course, in the world that we live in today, you can see that same sexual deviancy continuing to increase and increase more and more in the society that we live in. And so they pressed hard against Lot down in verse 9 there, and it says they came near to break the door. In other words, they're going to go in by force, but the men reached out their hands. They brought Lot into the house with them. They shut the door, and they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great. So now we now know, right? We know they're angels at this point. If you're Lot, up until this point, you didn't know they were angels. But at this point, when they strike everybody blind, you've got an inkling of what's going on here. But then it says, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. So now, imagine for yourself a second, these men, they've turned down the daughters, they've tried to break down the door, the angels have struck every single one of them blind, and what are they trying to do? They're still trying to get in the door. If you don't believe that the world can get dark, you've not read the scriptures. This is a dark world and a dark place, and it can get really bad. And this is what sin does. Sin feeds on itself to where it gets more and more and more and more. What people do not understand when they read in the scriptures about places like Sodom and Gomorrah, the general view is, well, see, the Bible is against homosexuality. And, of course, in one sense, that's true. Is the Bible against homosexuality? Yes, it definitely is. But what we're seeing here is not purely homosexuality, but a sinful behavior that has gotten them to this point. In other words, they didn't just wake up one morning in Sodom and Gomorrah and become these kind of people, did they? It's not like a week before everything was fine and nice and friendly and people were generally good fellows, and then these angels show up and whammo, everything goes bad. That's not the picture at all. In fact, your Bible, in later places when discussing Sodom and Gomorrah, will explain that idea, as well as mentioning it here. One, initially in chapter 18, verse 20, it says, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly great." Is homosexuality mentioned there? When he says their outcry is great and their sin is exceedingly grave. No, it's just sin, right? Then turn over your Bible to Ezekiel. See, when you thought you're coming to a Genesis class, what were the chances you thought we'd end up in Ezekiel? If you look over in Ezekiel and you start in chapter 16, and we get ourselves to verse 46. Now, in Ezekiel 16, the context is as God is rebuking Israel. But he says in verse 46, "Your older sister is Samaria, who lives north of you with her daughters, and your younger sister who lives south of you is Sodom with her daughters. Yet you have not merely walked in their ways and done according to their abominations, but as if that were too little, you acted more corruptly in all your conduct than they. As I live, declares the Lord God, Sodom, your sister, and her daughters have not done as you and your daughters have done." So first of all, by the time you get to the book of Ezekiel, how bad had Israel gotten? He says, worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. And then he says, "She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease, but she did not help the poor and needy. Thus they were haughty and committed abominations before me. Therefore I removed them when I saw it." Now in Ezekiel, does it even mention homosexuality? No. Now, I want you to be aware, by the way, what I just did is one way that modern society goes to try and twist the scriptures and say that God doesn't have a problem with homosexuality, by the way. That's one way they'll do it, is they'll say, no, actually, go over to Ezekiel 16 and you'll see homosexuality isn't the problem. It was just that they were prosperous and arrogant and didn't help the poor and the needy. So that was the sin. Now, if you take it that way, you've missed the point, haven't you? It's not that homosexuality wasn't a sin, because now turn over to Jude. Look real quick over there. Go over to New Testament, look at the book of Jude. Jude, down in verse 7, says of Sodom and Gomorrah, Jude verse 7 says, "Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire." Now, in verse 7 of Jude, is homosexuality mentioned? Going after strange flesh. So is homosexuality sin? Yes. Was that the only sin in Sodom and Gomorrah? No. I had a guy ask me one time, a young man who wanted to preach. He's in another state, and he felt like people in the church were just really tough on homosexuality and nothing else. And he wanted to know why do I care about homosexuality as a sin? Isn't it just like any other sin? And here's the thing. When you took all the arrogance and the prosperity and the careless ease and the not helping the poor and the needy and all these things that Ezekiel says happened in Sodom and Gomorrah, and you pile all those things together, what did you eventually end up with? The events of Genesis 19. It's not that homosexuality is worse than any others, but that oftentimes when a society gets to the point of openly embracing homosexuality, what do you know is built underneath that? whole bunch of other junk. That's right. By the time you get to that point, you've got a whole bunch of other junk underneath there too. And that's what we find with Sodom and Gomorrah, is this this great pile of sin, this outcry that the angels were sent to go and inspect, what, by the way, is the report card they're going to send back at this point. Right? They went to inspect the outcry against them, and if anything, it's worse than one would imagine. And so, as they wearied to try and find the door, these men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law and your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we're about to destroy this place, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Now that verse right there, verse 13, "their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." There's some principles in there that we could spend quite a bit of time talking about, couldn't we? Who puts nations into power and kings and rulers? The Lord, right? Romans 13 says quite clearly, the Lord is the one who appoints. Now here, does he pay any attention to what those rulers and nations do? Turns out very much so. And when the outcry of their wickedness, of their sin gets bad enough, what does he do? He destroys them. Does it matter how powerful they are? What did we read in Ezekiel about the state of things in Sodom and Gomorrah? He says they were prosperous and they had their was it carefree or careless ease? In other words, from a standpoint of economics, how was Sodom and Gomorrah faring? Very well. They were a very successful section of the world. We shouldn't be surprised by that, because when Lot had a choice of where to go, do you want to go this way or this way, which way did he choose to go? He went towards Sodom and Gomorrah, right? And he wanted to go there because it looked pretty good over there. So the economics were great, but the morality stunk. And so God didn't care about the economics. And so he's going to destroy them. And the same is true of any nation, including the one that we're in too, right? You know, we've got to just be aware of that, that as Christians, I am eternally optimistic about the state of Christianity. If things get really bad, guess what Christianity does when things get really bad? It seems to thrive just fine, doesn't it? You know, it just seems to do just fine. So from the state of Christianity, I have no worries whatsoever. We're going to be just fine. It's the kingdom that shall never be destroyed. As far as the country that I live in, I'll tell you, I'm happy to live in it, but I'm also pretty much eternally cynical and pessimistic about it. The long-term prognosis of America, should we expect it to be any different than any other nation? I mean, what happens long-term with every nation throughout history? The great ones eventually get to their arrogance and their pride, and their morality degrades, and God tears them out, right? And so it's not like we don't see that pattern here. I mean, do you see any of that sort of thing happening now, where our prosperity is degrading our morality? Of course it is, right? This is just the reality of the world that we live in, is that this is the nature of nations. But on the other hand, what's God going to do for Lot? He's going to save him. That's right, he's going to save him. So what's the Lord do for the righteous? Takes care of them. So we can have some confidence there. So Lot, he's going to go out. He's going to speak to his sons-in-law who were set to marry his daughters, tell them to leave, but they think he's joking, he's jesting. When the morning begins to dawn, the angels are once again to urge him, take your daughters, take your wife, get out of here. You don't want to get swept up in the punishment. And then you go down to verse 16, and it says, but he hesitated. So Lot, you can just imagine, he's stuck in the middle of all this. Obviously it's bad, but he just, have you ever had a big decision you had to make, and you had to make it fast until you froze like a deer in the headlights? That's what I imagine is going on here with Lot. God's offering him the escape route. Just get out. The whole city's going to be destroyed. But then his sons-in-law won't leave. And so he hesitates. And it says the hands of his the men seized his hand and the hands of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. So they just physically pick him up and get him out of the city because the Lord was compassionate to him, even though he hesitated. And so when they brought them outside, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away." Lot will have this conversation with them, eventually asking for, he's afraid that if they go stay out in the hills, that it won't be well for him. So he asks, "Can we flee to this city called Zoar?" They eventually say, "Sure." And then in verse 23, it says, "The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. And then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground." And then verse 26, "But his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt." And so you have Lot. He flees for his life, but his wife turns and looks back. And in fact, the New Testament will mention that in 2 Peter chapter 2. We'll be told, "Remember Lot's wife." Now, you don't even know her name, by the way. You don't know anything about Lot's wife except for one event in the whole history of the Scripture. She had a whole life there beforehand. But what's the one thing you know when it says, "Remember Lot's wife"? What's the only thing you and I are capable of remembering about her? She's a pillar of salt. She turned and looked back when they said, "Don't look back." And so in 2 Peter chapter 2, when it says, "Remember Lot's wife," what are you being told to remember? Don't look back, right? In fact, I'm misquoting. 2 Peter chapter 2 talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, but it's Luke 17 that talks about remember Lot's wife. The idea is that don't be like her. And you can imagine Sodom and Gomorrah, once again, economically doing well. Lot, as far as we could tell, had done well for himself. So when she looks back, what is she looking back? What kind of life did she have back there? She probably had quite a bit of financial well-to-do. Morally awful, right? I mean, morally just as depraved as can be. But in terms of the wealth of the place she lived and all of the physical possessions, had a pretty good life. So she looks back and turns into a pillar of salt. And so she's only really remembered for that one particular detail of her life. And so then down in verse 27, "Abraham arose early in the morning, went to the place where he had stood before the Lord, and he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. And thus it came about, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived." So now we're given an extra little detail. One, God's going to save Lot, and it says the Lord had compassion on him. We read that back in verse 16. But now we find out another detail of why did God have compassion on Lot? Because Abraham, that's right. God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst. So now let me ask you, can a righteous person affect the life of other people? Absolutely. That whole conversation that God had with Abraham affected the saving of Lot's life. And so when we talk about things like the prayers of a righteous person availeth much, or when people ask us to pray for them, or we ask each other to pray for us, you can make an impact. And make no mistake, it can be a very large impact. I mean, the difference between Abraham praying and entreating God on Lot's behalf, what sort of a difference did that make for Lot? What was the other option? Death, right? He's just going to die. So how much can prayers affect the world and affect people? Life and death. That's what we're told. Life and death. That big of a difference. So don't underestimate your power as a righteous person to pray to God, as one of his people, to entreat him through Jesus the Advocate. You can make a huge difference. So then, verse 30, Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him. Now, we skipped over this pretty quickly because I'm trying to not get too bogged down. But Lot had this whole conversation that he didn't want to stay in the mountains, so he asked if he could stay in the city of Zoar. But what did we just read happened as soon as he got to Zoar? He left Zoar and went to stay in the mountains. So in other words, did the angels give good advice in the first place? Yeah, you know, just listen to God. That's the message. You know, you're going to end up in the mountains anyways. And his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. And he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. And then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there's not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And on the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also, and then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." And so she does likewise. And then down verse 37, verse 36, "Thus both daughters of Lot were with child by their father." Now, could chapter 19 have more disgusting elements in it? I mean, it just highlights the problems and the depravity, right? So you have his Lot here, and he's in the midst of this society. Has that affected his daughters at all? I mean, they were growing up in Sodom and Gomorrah, right? The way that they're acting is connected to that sexual deviancy and moral depravity that we'd seen earlier in the people of the city. And then on top of it, I think we also get a little bit of an inkling of how terrifying a series of events this were, because their logic is that our father's old and there's not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. When they lay with their father, their logic is how many more men are left? They think nobody's left. From what I can tell reading, I think the most likely thing is that it was such a terrifying thing, the falling of Sodom and Gomorrah, the fire and the brimstone, they thought it was the end of the world. And so that's how awful the destruction was, how complete and total, and how total their terror. And so you have lots of layers of ugliness in Genesis 19. And it all comes together to lay out one simple message. So turn over your Bible to 2 Peter chapter 2. In 2 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 6, after talking about the great flood of Noah's day, he says, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example of those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard that righteous man while living among them felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority. The end result of reading that story for you and I is, does God know how to destroy ungodliness? Yeah, he most certainly does. And we're also told where that ungodliness comes from. It talks about they indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and they despise authority. You think of Sodom and Gomorrah. When you think of it in terms of indulging, that's a very scary word, because indulging doesn't sound that bad, right? You've had a long day, and at the end of the day, you think, I'll just indulge in a little bit of dessert, right? That's how we talk about dessert, isn't it? It's an indulgence. It's just something that doesn't seem like it would hurt anybody, but I just feel like I'm worth it. Now, I'm not saying this so that you'll give up dessert. But I want you to understand that's the way we use the word most of the time, right? is just this small thing that is kind of a guilty pleasure, right? That's why we use the word indulge. But in terms of sexual immorality, where does that always lead once you indulge the flesh? It's never satisfied, is it? The corruption continues and continues and continues until eventually you get the baseness of Sodom and Gomorrah and all the events that unfolded there. And so God is able to rescue the godly, and he's also able to keep the ungodly under punishment. So that is chapter 19. Anybody have any comments or questions? Yes. Absolutely. No. Correct. Yeah. Right. The anarchists and yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in Genesis 19, we see at least a hint at that despising authority, because Lot, when he comes out and tells them, don't do this wicked thing, they say, who is this guy? You know, I mean, you get that kind of despising of authority over his own, even just his authority is over his own house. In that case, he's just saying, these are my guests, leave them alone. And they, you know, so you're right, they're not necessarily derived from each other, but they oftentimes can kind of grow in tandem. You know, you and we see that in our society as well today, where you just see all those sorts of things growing from multiple directions to affect the society. Satan's a good multitasker, isn't he? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point, because you're right. It says they were afraid to stay in Zoar, so they had come there. And so, yeah, that's a good point in that they must have seen some people living there. Yeah, so whatever that logic is, that somehow they thought the family line's going to die out. Yeah, so, yeah, you're right. So that's a good point to that. I hadn't thought about that. Good point. Anybody else have any other comments or questions? Okay, so then we move to chapter 20. Chapter 20 we're going to cover fairly quickly, because it's kind of a repeat of a previous chapter. When Abraham had gone down to Egypt, what did Abraham say to the Pharaoh? Sarah is my sister. Now, technically that is correct, and in this chapter in particular he will clarify that. Verse 12 of chapter 20 says, besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. So there is that connection, but is that beside the point when you say, well, this is my sister, and another man takes her to be his wife? Yeah, you absolutely. Okay. So he did it before because he was fearful. Chapter 20, now he's going to travel from there toward the land of the Negev. The Negev is the south land, and settled between Kadesh and Shur. And then he sojourned in Gerar. And it says, Abraham said of Sarah's wife, she is my sister. So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. So now we just have a repeat, right? Same thing. And Abimelech's going to take her to be his wife. Apparently she is still a beautiful woman. It's been quite a few years since the first time, but he takes her to be his wife as well. But God's going to come to Abimelech in a dream, and he's going to tell him, you're a dead man, because the woman whom you've taken, for she is married. Abimelech, after having that vision, will approach Abraham and say, why did you do this thing? And so you go down to, let's see here, verse 5. Did he not himself say to me, she is my sister, and she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I've done this. In other words, Abimelech's answer to God is, I didn't mean to do anything wrong. And then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you've done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. Now, here's kind of an interesting little detail out of chapter 20 that is worth taking a moment to note, is that at the beginning, when Abimelech didn't know anything, he could say, I have integrity of heart and innocence of hands. I didn't mean to and I didn't know. So God's answer to him is, I understand that, but now you do know, and what are you going to do about it? Yeah, restore. And if you don't restore, what's going to happen? You're going to die, because now you can't say you did it in integrity of heart. This is a very good argument, by the way, for dealing with people who say, but I have been trying to serve God my whole life, and you're telling me that since I'm not baptized, I'm not saved. Well, I didn't know I needed to be baptized. Well, what's the answer to the guy who didn't know he needed to be baptized? Now you do. That's the answer, right? Now you do. Now you do, and what are you going to do about it, right? Do I need to be worried about the hypothetical guy who's in the desert who wants to be baptized and can't? Is that really my problem? I've never met that guy. I keep hearing stories about that guy. Never met him. But he's not my problem. My problem is me. And when I know what I need to do, the moment I realize it, now I can no longer say I'm ignorant. What am I going to do about it? And so that's what God says to Abimelech, is, okay, now you know, restore her. So Abimelech, he'll arise early in the morning. He's going to approach Abraham in verse 9 and say, what have you done to us, and how have I sinned against you that you brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You've done to me things that ought not to be done. And Abimelech is right, by the way. When we as God's people do not live up to the standard of living as we ought to, what do we do to those around us who we should be a model for? We create circumstances that are unhealthy and not in the benefit of them, right? Instead of Abraham being a blessing to Abimelech, his fearfulness had become a curse to Abimelech, hadn't it? And there's a lesson there to us. We can't live in fear. We got to be bold in our faith to trust the Lord and not be afraid of people. So Abraham will say in verse 11, because I thought surely there's no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Now, first of all, was Abraham right that there was no fear of God in that place? No, he was wrong. Did Abimelech have some fear of God? Yes, he did. So one, do you know when people are fearing, there are God-fearing people or not? Do you know people's hearts? No, you don't. There was a, when Paul came to the city of Corinth, he thought, I'm going to die in this city. It's a pagan, Gentile city. I'm going to die here. It's going to be bad. And you know what God said to him? He says, don't be afraid. I have many people in this city. And there are a lot of people converted in the city of Corinth. So it just goes to show you, we don't know. And then the second thing is even if that is true, even if everybody in the territory of Gerar don't fear God, should that change the way that Abraham acts? Right? Just, we don't take a poll on our Christianity, do we? You don't say, well, if everybody else is doing it, then I'll be faithful to God. That's not faith at all. And so, just another lesson here. Now, once again, with Abraham, is Abraham a good man? Yes. He's the father of the faithful. So, you don't have to be perfect to be pleasing to God and to be loved by God. But he made mistakes, and we learn from those mistakes too. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He was a stumbling. Did he put Abimelech in a position where Abimelech was at risk of sinning? Yeah, that's a stumbling block. I don't know how else you'd define it, right? Yeah, so absolutely. I think that that's exactly right. He's going to restore Abraham's wife, Sarah, to him. And Abimelech will say to him in verse 15, behold, my land is before you, settle wherever you please. And to Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you, and before all men you are cleared." In other words, he didn't want her reputation sullied. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maid so that they bore children. So now there's another detail that we were unaware of. There were already some consequences that were going on of sickness due to this circumstance. For the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So that ends chapter 20, and then we move into chapter 21, which heads us back into the main storyline, which is God had been dealing with all of mankind, and then he called Abraham out, and he says, "I'm going to make you the father of many nations." And God has told him he would have a child through Sarah. And so we've kind of diverted from that for a couple of chapters to look at these different other details with Sodom and Gomorrah and then this case with Abimelech. But now we're back on to the main storyline, which is Sarah is supposed to have a baby, right? So chapter 21 takes us to that. The Lord took note of Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. Now, by the way, when chapter 18 happened, and God had sent the angels, the angels had said, how long would it be from when those angels came until Sarah had a child? Anybody remember? 1 year. 1 year. So now, 1 year has passed, right? So now at chapter 21, we're seeing that 1 year pass. So Sarah conceived, bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Remember, what does Isaac mean? Laughter. Yeah, because both Abraham and Sarah had laughed. And so it says, then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. Now, here's this kind of multiple layers of this name Isaac that is just kind of fun, is that the first laughter that Abraham and Sarah had was what kind of a laughter? It's disbelief. That's right. That'll never happen. That'll never happen. But now she names him Isaac, and she adds another type of laughter. She says, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. What kind of laughter is this? It's joy. Yes, it's a joy. I finally have this child. And so she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I bore him a son in his old age. The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. And so now we have this child, Isaac, who is born, and he's the child of what? What does the New Testament tell us about him? He's the child of promise. That's right. God had made a promise, and the only reason Isaac was born was because God had made a promise. But now in chapter 21, we have another child, don't we? We have the child of promise, but there is another child, Ishmael, who was the child through Hagar. And we're going to see them sent away. Sarah is going to turn Hagar away. And as we talked about before, I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on it now, that when all of this happened, this is not good. None of these things are good. But God will use these two women as a type. There is Hagar with and Ishmael with the natural-born child who represents what? Anybody remember? What do they represent? In Galatians, it tells us they represent the people under the old law. Under the old law, the natural thing is God makes a law, and what do? Whenever God gives us a law, what does every person do since Adam and Eve? We reject it. We sin, right? That's the natural thing, and then we're cast out. And that's exactly what's going to happen with Hagar and Ishmael. They're cast out. But in the case of Isaac is the child of promise. Something crazy happens. Child born to a 90-year-old woman when her husband's 100. It's just miraculous. And so too, we as Christians, when we sin, something miraculous happens. And what is that miraculous thing that you and I can have when we sin? We've got forgiveness because God sent his own son down to die for us. He made us promises, great and faithful promises, that we can go to heaven anyways. And so chapter 21, Sarah will turn Hagar and Ishmael out. It will distress Abraham, but God will say to let it happen. He will say, remember, Isaac is the one I'm going to use. He's the one that through whom your descendants will be. But he also promises him in verse 13 of chapter 21, the son of the maid I will make a nation also because he is your descendant. So don't worry. He's not going to die. I will take care of him. But Hagar and Ishmael are sent away. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, then we will stop there. We'll pick up about halfway through chapter 21 and into chapter 22 next week.